they are sacrificing this tremendous value, that they are breaking faith with this great pattern of life that has demanded that each generation shall be better or the world shall fail. Now, we are gravely concerned about some of the generation growing up, a generation that was bred in war and depression, a generation which is bearing witness today to the selfishness, indifference, or ignorance of its parents. Unless this situation changes, we have no security to look forward to. We have no reason to hope that our children will be safe, even if we try, so long as they grow up in a world of neglected souls. And this is the great situation. The neglect of souls, the neglect of life, the constant growth of minds, and the neglect of spirits. These problems are real. Now, we know in business that various firms and corporations are taking a deep and continuing interest in the family lives of their executives. They realize that the individual, without the support of family, whose family is exploiting him on the one hand while life is exploiting him on the other, that this individual will break. And as a result of that is a poor risk for any position of responsibility. It used to be considered a good policy to train men, wear them out, throw them away, and replace them. It is now becoming obvious that this is too expensive. What industry wants today is exactly what society needs: well-integrated people. Industry, business, economics today wants the happy, well-adjusted family person. Wants an individual who is secure in the respect and admiration of his family, who is cared for, who is loved and respected, and who has every reason to say with pride, "My family is wonderful." These are the things that help to sustain individuals under the pressure of present world conditions. And a great many cases of failure in business can be traced directly to failure in the home. But so often today, the home doesn't really care anymore. It goes on its own way, doing as it pleases. Each individual unmindful of their responsibilities to the combination which we call home life. So if you are planning a home, think it through carefully. If you have a home, try to strengthen it through your own efforts and by trying to bring more and more of value into the home. Realize, however, what the Japanese discovered, that when you try to make this change, if you find that this home has nothing in it that will hold improvement, then the marriage was not well consummated, not thought out, not given reason and value. Today, marriage counselors are being called in to help young people to make selections in these areas. Perhaps they are one of the best sources of immediate help in need. Also, families that are in trouble should certainly seek counseling, either with professional counselors or with their ministers. There should be outside help to try to straighten out these situations, and they should be approached honestly. If a home is impossible, there is actually no reason to tolerate it. If it is one of these things that can never get well, then those in it are going to get sicker and sicker. And under such conditions, those who strive desperately to hold it together are wrong and are trying to support a hopeless cause. Think these things through clearly and try to get a better foundation under your life. If you are in a home and domestic situation, try it with everything that you have and are to make it better. Get over, if you can, this constant sense of having been cheated by life. And realize that you are not cheated by life if you know it. If you know that a certain situation exists, no one is cheating you. They are merely confronting you with an unpleasant situation that you must face. If then there is any possible way of making this condition better, you should use all constructive and reasonable means. If you are impatient, and this is bringing the crisis more frequently, cultivate patience. If you have lived with a person for many years, try to find the good in that person. Try to find again the person you married. That person is there somewhere. Realize also that life and health problems may modify dispositions, but that it always takes two to make an argument. And if one will not argue, there is no argument. Try not to be hypersensitive. Try to be just, but do not be too easily bruised. Also, recognize difficulties as opportunities for strength. The sword of spirit is tempered for the flame of suffering. The individual who rises above a situation by the strength of his own character has a great achievement, and a great achievement is never lost. I've known several persons who came to me with problems bearing upon this issue. They said, well, it's useless. The other person's impossible. Maybe. But at the time these people came to me, there were two impossible persons. One who was always wrong and the other who was always hurt. In a few instances, I have been able to induce the one who regarded themselves as the sufferer to try to take a new basic relationship to the situation. Take it for granted that the other person isn't going to change. This you cannot force. But also take it for granted that you can change yourself if you want to. So we try to help these people to develop a more positive, constructive, helpful, optimistic attitude toward the situation. And in many cases, I learned afterwards that to everyone's amazement, both persons changed. The individual who kept alive a controversy found ways to no longer support it, to no longer add fuel to it. And the other person also altered their attitudes. They came off of a defensive onto which they had been forced. So one person, by changing themselves, may change many. But any person setting out basically to change someone else first will change nothing except for the worse. If you can break up your own relationship to a difficult dispositional situation, you may create an entirely new cell with a different compound. And I think we can say safely that in a family of six persons, if one makes a major change in temperament, the other five will also be modified to some degree. Consequently, nature has provided us with the only possible key to this dilemma: change self. If you have so changed yourself out of a situation of this kind that you no longer deserve it, the chances are very strong that the situation itself will basically alter. We are in a certain locked pattern of difficulties because we deserve to be there. And the moment we no longer deserve a situation, we are not the victim of it. Everything has to be deserved. Both happiness and misery must be earned. And the person is miserable because they have not yet learned enough to outgrow their own misery. And we have all taken it for granted that we are miserable because of others. While this continues, there is no answer to anything. We try desperately to change other people, and we all die of a broken heart together. It will not work. I have noted on some scores of occasions in the last 45 years that people locked into situations were released by changing themselves. The situations broke up. Patterns changed, basically, the moment the existing pattern was no longer necessary for educational purposes. So we strongly advise the individual to seek solution by solving a problem in himself, realizing that the shortcut to peace is to cease discord in yourself. That no matter what the problem is, if you will solve your own relationship to that problem, you will be liberated from it. The reason that you are not liberated is because you have not solved. Also, if you solve the problem correctly, you are not only freed of the present emergency, but most of all, you are liberated from those negative memories, those long-range heartaches, those unforgivable affronts that we nurse from the moment they occur to the grave. We can actually free ourselves from one of the most dangerous of all enemies, and that is our own unhappy, dishonest memories. The long-range self-pity that comes from this conviction that the whole world is wrong and we are the victim. Let's, for our own good, just change the whole pattern. If we believe long enough that we are the innocent victims of others, we will end with a mental or emotional breakdown because we live in a dishonest universe. And if the universe is dishonest, what can any of us do? The only way out of this problem is to recognize our own responsibility and recognize that the only thing that nature expects of us is that we shall outgrow any littleness that is burdening us with pain. We do this. We keep our pact with life itself. I think in the case of the same domestic situation, Buddhistic philosophy is most helpful. Buddhism simply teaches that all relationships in life are psychological. That actually no people are bound by any ties to other people. They are bound only by attitudes, by voluntary commitments. And an individual who is bound by love is no longer bound if that love dies. We are bound by our attachments, and we are, in a certain sense, also negatively bound by our antagonisms, because when we are antagonistic, we can never be free of the object of our antagonism. So in Buddhism, all these attitudes are simply conditions that arise in ourselves. We say to ourselves, we are hurt. Immediately we are hurt. We say that there is no justice in the universe. Immediately, the universe bursts forth with a vast blaze of injustice. We say that other people are cruel. Immediately, cruelty moves in upon us from all directions. All of these are estimates. And while we are suffering from our estimate, our next-door neighbor is enjoying himself greatly in the same situation because his estimate is different. To the friendly person, the universe is friendly. To the unfriendly, the universe is antagonistic. but it's all one world. And it's one world of things simply as they are. It is our own attitudes that gild these various realities and make them dramatic, or cover them with a dark cloud of despondency. So it all rests with us. It may be that in some past time we have had unfinished business with other people. We injured them. Buddha said, if so, we must pay this injury. So if other individuals are cruel, the only answer, as he says, is patience. To meet the payment with insight. With the realization that out of the full meeting of debt, we achieve liberation. But we must also be continuously watchful lest we create further negative situations for ourselves. The only way to ensure our own happiness in this life or in any life that lies beyond is to live with complete sincerity now. To do always that which is the kindest and noblest that we know. To hold no grudges. To perpetuate no grievances. Neither to condemn nor to blame, but always in all things striving continuously for an inward peace and an experience of the goodness of life itself. That all these experiences and all these things are lessons which we can learn. If we can learn them happily, we have happiness here. If we can only learn them through misery, we are miserable here. But in the great pattern of things, all these situations that arise are simply of our desiring. We have allowed the flames of anger or hate to rise and burn and injure us. Every negative attitude destroys. Every unkind thought sickens. And wherever we have these relationships with other people, if these relationships are good, everyone is enriched. If they are negative, if they are selfish, if they are ulterior, everyone is impoverished. The individual who marries another person simply for security has no right to expect happiness. An individual who will unite in matrimony. And at the same time, as some have told me, they have said simply, I married this person, but I didn't care for them. How can such an individual expect anything from it? How can they expect a false attitude of their own, supported by deceit, to produce anything but misery? All these things have to be understood and thought through. We have to be scrupulously honest in our emotional relationships. We have to be true to the best of our ability, or we create terrible penalties. I think, therefore, that our main concern at the moment, perhaps, is to review life, assuming that we are in one of three relationships to life at the present time. Either we are young, starting out. If so, we should use every means in our power to understand the responsibilities of mature life. We should never permit our lives to be defeated merely by some passing impulse of the moment. We should think things through. Marry persons whom we admire. Unite ourselves with those whose virtues we know to be solid and reliable. To think through the long day in which these relationships must endure. And if we have started out with some distinct and sincere effort to make a good thing of a marriage, to be prepared to be unselfish, to be prepared to sacrifice something of ourselves. It is sacrifice that makes us great and gratification that keeps us small. We have the right, therefore, to that wonderful growth of the individual who forgets himself in dedicated service to that which he admires or respects. And if he truly admires and truly respects, this dedication is not difficult. But if this true admiration is not present, the dedication is almost tragic. Those who have gone on into the middle stream of life, who have established their families, may perhaps be experiencing a rather unpleasant boredom. They have reached the realization that they are married to uninteresting people. People who have not bright and sparkling ideas. People who are heavy and logy and well settled in their ruts. People who are not glamorous and lack the quality of the gallant movie star. People who we have to look at every day and wonder why in the world we ever married them in the first place. And then we begin to soften a little. We get a bit of guilt over our own feelings. We remember that these people have been faithful. They have tried. They had one tremendous drawback which we didn't recognize soon enough. They were dull. And being dull, they were good providers. And being good, honorable providers, they were almost certainly dull. But this is life. Now, under such conditions as this, boredom can lead gradually to tragedy. The individual becomes desperate in the presence of a situation that seems to be tightening around them. At 20, it wasn't so serious. They might do something about it at 30. But at 50, it gets to be serious, because nobody knows what they're going to do about it at 60. Probably nothing. They're just going to endure each other to the grave. This is enough to cause a very noble frustration. What can you do about such cases as this? Well, one thing that everyone can do and can desperately try to communicate is interest. To find, if humanly possible, an interest in common. Now, I've had people come to me and say, yes, that's a splendid idea, but the only things that this other person is interested in, I am not interested in. Yeah? That can be. But you could also reverse the statement and simply say that the only things you're interested in, the other person isn't interested in. These things read both ways. Someone in this pattern has got to make the big step. Step out from their own interest and try to find the interests of another person. This can be done and has paid off on a number of very remarkable occasions. We are not very sure sometimes about how interesting other people's interests can be, if we have spent all our lives regretting that they had them and defeated because they didn't have our interests. Someone may have to step across this interval. And if it cannot be the other person for lack of insight, then it may have to be you. But try to find this interest. Find something that can be done together. Because as you get older, you fall into the Japanese pattern. It becomes more and more vital that you have togetherness. You have to have this support, or else life gets to be very difficult. Sometimes also these uninteresting people can unite their resources upon some other person or some project. They may find a common ground in their children or their grandchildren. They may find some philanthropy that intrigues them both. Or they may be able to take a friendly, if not profound, interest in each other's activities. Finding in these common activities the basis of a very valuable conversation. Because if each, in his own way, can have experiences and communicate them, these experiences can be the basis of common interest. But where this dullness exists, there must be some effort made to try to fill it. And if all else fails, and nothing seemingly can fill it, then the person who recognizes the need must take on new activities, must find ways of self-expression that give them a larger fulfillment in life. It is a matter of planning a project to prevent this dullness from settling in, because if it does, life is going to be very unhappy. Now, with the very aged, those whose lives are in the very late evening, there may not be quite so many pressures or so much to be accomplished. Usually there is a certain deep discouragement by this time, if there is problem, or the individual is resigned to inevitables, and very often the tensions and pressures and antagonisms slowly relax. If they do not, that is a sign there is much too much psychotic pressure. But for the older people, the inner life becomes the great solution to all things. Contemplation, kindliness. The aged, like the very young, build halos around those they love. The aged see virtues where they are not, even as middle life sees vices where they may not be. But in the older years, the individual naturally seeks to put his own life in order. He wants to have a good spirit for the transition that lies ahead. So in those older years, the person is susceptible to mysticism, to prayerfulness, to religious insight, to those patiences that arise from faith. And as glamours and these matters have become less, it is quite possible for these people to find a rather quiet, congenial, friendly relationship. In our Western world, married couples who have made it for 40 or 50 years are most successful if in the end they have become friends. This seems to be the one reward. And friendliness comes again to be less selfish. A friend, in a sense, is one we serve because we regard them well. And this, in very many instances, is the best description that we have of older compatibilities. They are friendly. There is no need of these terrible tempests of emotion and attitude. Rather, quietude becomes the major solution. I think that in the modern business today, in modern problems, there are things we should bear in mind. I think that every person who is unable, through his educational facilities, to find some basic insight into marital problems and domestic situations should at least read carefully a few well-selected texts on the subject, and should, if possible, discuss their emotional plans with a clergyman or a counselor. As the situations arise in life, the individual simply cannot see them clearly enough by the background of our ways. 50, 75 years ago, many marriages began in church associations. The parents went to the same church. The young people more or less grew up together. This was some supporting help. They had a faith in common. Because they came from the same church background, they also had certain social compatibilities. But these no longer are protectives. Individuals now marry with little regard to previous association, and sometimes in great haste. Occasionally these hurried marriages are inspired and wonderful, but they can also present problems as time goes on. If problems arise, what are the young people equipped to do these days? Very little, if anything. The problems that arise have to be solved the best they know how. If they are very honest young people, they may solve them among themselves. If they are less solutional, they may turn to family. If the family is called upon, it must be wise, unselfish, kind, and just. Otherwise, it will complicate the situation more. All through this hectic period of from 30 to 50 years, in which human beings must labor with these problems of relationships, the pressures are difficult, and today the nervous tension is very serious. It is much worse than it has ever been before. The only answer we have for any of these things is an answer that you cannot force upon anyone, but which is the only answer. The only answer to all error is truth, regardless of how you look at it. And truth in matrimony and in family relationships is a very simple thing. Truth is a very flat statement that true love forgets self in the service of that which it loves. And two people who forget themselves take good care of each other. But each individual trying desperately to take care of himself, nothing is cared for properly. So all our basic relationship in life depends upon the individual putting the good of others before his own. In matrimony, this is absolutely necessary. In raising of children, there is great sacrifice, for it is not always easy today to meet the challenge of young people, their education, their personalities, and their problems. But it can only happen where there is a deep affection. If this affection is absent, the parents will go into nervous decline, they will collapse, they will be mental and emotionally sick, and will probably end by breaking up their homes, largely under the pressure of their children's requirements. Whether it be in relation to children or parents or husband and wife, the final answer to this whole thing, as Buddha pointed out in the Nikkha Sutra, is unselfish love. Love suffereth long and is kind. Where we love, we give our time and our conspiracy to bringing happiness to the beloved. When we love, we do not wish to bring a moment of pain or strain or sorrow or burden to the person we care for. If we observe that we are spending so much that the other person is worried, we would no longer spend, because to keep this person happy is our happiness. If to get what we want is our happiness, we have broken the rule and therefore have forfeited our right to good family relationships. In all these matters, true love solves problems. True love does not overlook the weaknesses in others. But this affection remains regardless. And our natural affection is to serve and help that which we love. Today we desperately need the experience of honest love, and very few people have it. We can never build a good generation while our final affection is reserved for ourselves. Too many people today are in love with themselves. And a person in love with himself can never be in love with anything else. In the effort, therefore, to cater forever to self, we sacrifice others and their happiness and their rights to our own desires. Where we know this temperament and this characteristic is strong in us, we have no right to create families. Because the individual who does not have the natural instinct to give of himself for that which he loves has no basis for marriage or parenthood. And as our generation is taught selfishness and is taught the importance of keeping mind largely upon self in the name of success, we are training people to be bad husbands and wives. We are training them to overlook their basic natural instincts and take on an assumed and false combativeness which can bring them neither satisfaction nor peace of soul. So I think the answer to all of our big questions is true love. Love that is not founded in physical things alone, but love that is founded in the desire of the individual to protect, to serve, to help that which it loves. Love must always have in it the desire to save the other person from pain, from sorrow, from hurt. Love does not demand, it gives. Love requires nothing of itself. Love does not even demand that it be returned. But as St. Francis so wisely pointed out, that the great mystery of love is to love, not to be loved. The individual who, in the full expression of a deep devotion, dedicates itself to the happiness of another, in this protects and fulfills its own happiness. For then whatever we do that brings joy to another brings joy to ourselves. In this way our happiness is magnified and increased because we have learned the art of creating happiness. We have learned that the only happiness that we can really have is when we have been of constructive, valuable service to the needs of others. If we have this attitude, we can be fathers and mothers, and we will succeed. Because in that condition, we have a happiness and a dedication that is most truly spiritual. We have something that transcends, something that lifts us up. And in this true dedication, we really cannot be hurt because we would not even know hurting. We are not hurt if we are not selfish. We are not hurt if we demand nothing for ourselves. And in a strange, mysterious way, our very unselfishness brings us the greatest securities that we can possibly know. So in these times when sincerity is not too common, we can strongly advocate it. We can also point out the tremendous need for honest affection. An affection that causes the parent to really love the child, not by word and not by gift, but by association. A parent that would gladly give the child many physical comforts, provide for it, educate it, will not give that child the parent's own companionship. The parent is too busy, doing too many other important things. It is enough to provide for the child. It is not enough. It is never enough unless the child receives love. And love is again the giving up of self to the need of that child. And it is this giving up which later the child will reward by an enduring affection. And if this giving up of self is not present, the child will stray away and the parent will feel alone and deserted. So these devout devotions, these simple integrities, these great principles of truth, must underlie domestic relations. Where they do, these relations do succeed. Where they are absent, we have the panorama of today of great emotional instability, sickness, misery, all, as Buddha points out, traceable to one thing, self-interest. That which is forever seeking the superiority of itself, that which is forever seeking the advancement of itself, fails in all things. For it is like the man of whom it is said, if he saves his life, he shall lose it. But if he loses his life for the sake of truth, you shall have life everlasting. And to give of self for the sake of love, for the sake of those whom we have loved and whom we do love and who need us and who depend upon us. This affection prepares us to receive love everlasting. We have to earn it. And all of our relationships have to be upon these integrities, or they will certainly fail. The only answer to our domestic problem of today is that we love someone sufficiently to forget ourselves. For everyone who is sick mentally and emotionally is thinking too much about himself. And health is the forgetting of self in the remembering of something greater than self. And to everyone who truly loves, that which he loves is greater than himself, whether it be his marriage partner, his child, or his God in heaven. For it is the giving of self in love that is the perfection of the alchemy of human relationships. And when we do this, nature rewards us mightily. And we should teach this. We should convey it to our children. We should make it part of the basic code of modern life. Well, I guess our time is up, so we thank you very much.